Good afternoon. From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry. A civil lawsuit aimed at preserving a historic neighborhood in the capital city is set for trial next summer. Juneau City government, meanwhile, plans to demolish the neighborhood before then. At a hearing yesterday, Superior Court Judge Amanda Browning set the trial date for August 2026. Three longtime tenants of the city-owned Telephone Hill neighborhood filed the lawsuit in October. It seeks to both stop the city's demolition and reverse the eviction of renters. City Attorney Emily Wright says, as it stands legally, nothing is holding the city back from continuing with demolition.
There's nothing stopping forward movement. So right now, the timeline that the city manager's office is working on is a March demo.
After years of public debate, the Juneau Assembly approved demolishing the homes on the hill this spring to redevelop the area into newer, denser housing. The Assembly says it's needed to address Juneau's lack of housing. But the tenants' lawsuit claims that the city improperly evicted people on the hill, illegally phased the redevelopment, and the project fails to comply with federal and state historic preservation acts. The city has repeatedly denied these claims. Following Wednesday's hearing, the tenants' attorney, Fred Treem, says he intends to file a motion to prevent the demolition, pending the outcome of the August trial. Judge Browning will decide whether to accept it or deny it.
We want to save the old buildings. That's the object of the suit. And we will move forward in the court system with our efforts to protect the buildings while we await the trial presently scheduled for August.
At the hearing, Judge Browning also ruled on a couple of eviction cases the city filed against remaining tenants who refused to vacate by the city's November 1st deadline. While Judge Browning ruled in favor of the city's right to evict two residences, she gave different eviction deadlines to the tenants because of their personal circumstances. A third eviction case is still pending. With Juneau expecting to see temperatures in the single digits and even below zero this week, residents may be tempted to recreate on frozen lakes around town. KTOO's Mike Lane spoke with Juneau Fire Chief Rich Etheridge about a recent incident of someone falling through the ice and what to do if it happens and other safety precautions when venturing out on frozen bodies of water.
We understand that somebody went through the ice on Mendenhall Lake recently. Can you describe what happened or how CCFR was involved?
Sure, I can let you know our involvement. The person was out on the ice recreating, doing their own thing. While they were doing that, we were busy taking care of an apartment fire out in the valley. And just as we were wrapping up and clearing from that incident, dispatch said that there was a person in the parking lot that had fallen through the ice, had hypothermia, and needed some medical care. So JPD went racing out there to get him in a warm vehicle to get things going. And then our folks showed up in the ambulance to start the rewarming process and getting them taken care of and get them up to Bartlett to go get checked out.
That rewarming process, what does that entail?
Usually it's cranking up the heat in the back of the ambulance, warm blankets. You know, if they're extremely hypothermic, we can do warm IVs to start getting some warm fluids in their blood. And then getting them up to the hospital where they can do a lot more. The trick is to warm them up controlled so that you don't put their body in more shock.
When someone does fall through the ice on Mendenhall Lake or any other lake for that matter, what is CCFR's typical response?
Sure. Especially Mendenhall Lake, it takes about 20, 25 minutes for people to get from Glacier Station to the lake on their suits and headed out onto the ice.
What precautions do they take as responders to not fall through the ice
sure.
as well?
We've got a couple of things. If the ice thickness is sufficient, we've got some four-wheelers on great big tracks for getting out there as quick as we can. They can use that to get out there, but they wear ice rescue suits. They're like a big Gumby suit that insulates them and it's buoyant and protects them from the temperature. So if they do go through the ice, they've got quite a bit of time to self-rescue or have their partner rescue them. We practice that every year. We go cut holes in some of the local ponds or out at the float pond at the airport, and people jump in and practice getting rescued.
What makes Mendenhall Lake particularly unsafe to go out on when it's frozen?
Sure. Mendenhall Lake's really unpredictable. There's a lot of currents, especially with Nugget Falls pouring into the lake. You get a lot of currents in there. And so any place you have moving water, you're going to have shallow, thin areas of ice. And then also the icebergs, they act kind of like a heat sink. And so the areas right around the icebergs tend not to freeze as thick. And you can still have an iceberg roll in the wintertime and break the ice around it.
Now, are there any lakes in Juneau that are okay to go out on when it's frozen?
There's some that I feel are safer than others. You know, if you go to like Twin Lakes, you're at least visible, and you don't have the currents flowing through it that you do in other places. The Duck Pond out off Riverside Drive. places where you're more visible, you've got less travel distance to get to someplace warm, I think is a good thing to look for.
How could a person determine whether the lake ice is safe to walk or skate or bike on or snow machine, whatever it might be?
Sure. The rule of thumb I've always heard is, you know, 4 inches for people to be safe out on the ice. But I'm a big old chicken, so I like at least a good foot out there before I go out.
And what warning signs should people look for before going on a frozen body of water?
Look at the areas along the shore, you know, do those break up? You know, do you have the ability to kind of drill through the ice and, you know, with like a hand drill and see how thick it is?
Now, if someone were to venture out onto a frozen lake but wanted to bring proper safety equipment, what would that be?
You know, a PFD is not a bad idea. Ropes, you know, long poles that, you know, if you do go through the ice, you got something to hang on to, you know, help pull you up out of the area. You know, but you really only have a few minutes to do anything significant once you hit that water. It's so bitter cold that your hands go numb really fast, and getting out is extremely important. You lose the feeling and gross motor functions pretty quickly.
What if I witnessed somebody go through the ice? What would I do as a witness or a bystander?
Sure. First thing is to call 911 because that response time does take time to keep an eye on where we're at. I've seen them. And if you've got equipment that you can safely, you know, attempt to help them get out of the ice, you could do so, whether you've got a rope you can throw them or, you know, things like that, sledge you could scoot out to them. But going up to the area where they just fell through is kind of a bad idea.
That was KTOO's Mike Lane speaking with Juneau Fire Chief Rich Etheridge. And over a dozen Southeast Alaska tribal governments have banded together to form a new partnership. The Alliance of Sovereign Tribes of Southeast Alaska was signed into accord last month at the National Congress of American Indians Convention in Seattle. The joint effort, which was months in the making, promotes a unified approach to addressing regional tribal concerns while acknowledging each tribe's individual differences. The accord also highlights the need for annual tribal gatherings and a focus on Indigenous values. Gloria Burns is the president of the Ketchikan Indian community. She says the new partnership has already improved communication between the region's tribes.
And as we communicate, then we're going to partner with each other. And when we partner with each other, then we're creating real movement and change with each other.
While organizations like the Alaska Federation of Natives address statewide issues, Burns says there were no collaborative efforts to tackle Southeast-specific concerns, like transboundary mining and invasive European green crabs. She says the new alliance also works to uplift individual tribal concerns. Albert Smith is the mayor of the Metlakatla Indian community, the only reservation in Alaska. He says there hasn't been an established partnership of Southeast Alaska tribes in over 20 years.
The importance is tribes helping tribes, working together for a common goal, the betterment of our region and indigenous peoples of our region.
Other tribal governments that signed into the alliance include the Craig Tribal Association, the Organized Village of Cake, and the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. And federal funding for libraries and museums has been reinstated 9 months after the Trump administration sought to eliminate the agency that provides the money. The initial move sparked concern around Alaska, where dozens of tribes and villages rely on federal dollars to pay library staff and offer programming. At the time, a handful of libraries reported grant cancellations. But the U.S. agency known as the Institute of Museum and Library Services said in early December that all federal grants had been restored. The move came after a Rhode Island district court judge ruled that the funding cancellation was unlawful. Some libraries in Alaska that lost funding have received notice that it's been reinstated. But in at least two cases, that happened months before the recent ruling. The Tuzzi Consortium Library in Ukiagvik saw a major grant cancellation earlier this year, but received a reinstatement notice in July. It said the agency had determined the grant was in line with the agency's priorities and the president's agenda. The library in the native village of Klukwan, outside of Haines, lost the bulk of its funding in the spring. Both of the library's two grants have now been restored, Klukwan Library co-director Jamie Katzik said in an email. Katzik did not say when the funding was restored, but a school library newsletter published in August announced new hours and upcoming events. It said that was possible because the library had received a new grant and another had been reinstated. The dollars will provide funding for staff hours and community programming, Katzik said, adding that the library is currently reworking its budget, but plans to be open 5 or 6 days each week. And a 37-year-old Kodiak man, who's been held at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Washington State for months, had a toe amputated after advocates said he was denied adequate medical care while in ICE custody. As KMXT's Davis Hovey reports, his deportation to the Philippines has been temporarily halted.
Greggy V. Sorio has been held at the Northwest Ice Processing Center in Tacoma since at least March. Sorio is from the Philippines and came to the U.S. on a green card in 2007, according to his attorney. He was living in Kodiak prior to being detained by ICE, and Luis Carhart, his attorney, told the Seattle Times that Sorio has a partner and two children who still live on the island. Sorio said in a recorded video message posted on Facebook that he suffered multiple instances of medical neglect while he has been detained at the ICE facility for months. The Tacoma Detention Center has been reported to the State Department of Health for its poor conditions for several years, according to KOMO News in Washington. According to the Seattle Times, Sorio had one of his toes amputated while he was in ICE custody. After being hospitalized for weeks, he developed a chronic inflammatory bowel disease, which requires ongoing medical care. Advocates with the Tongol Migranti movement told KMXT via email that Sorio's medical condition is life-threatening, and they will continue to advocate for him to receive comprehensive medical care at a hospital and be released from ICE custody. The movement says they successfully advocated for Sorio to be removed from a Philippine Airlines flight earlier this month after they reported to the airline that he was unfit to travel on a more than 14-hour flight to the Philippines. According to reporting from Fox 13 Seattle, an ICE spokesperson said that ICE is aware of Sorio's medical concerns and that they were working to meet his medical requirements before his scheduled flight on December 7th. As of December 8th, a federal judge granted Sorio a temporary restraining order preventing him from being deported or removed from Washington State until December 22nd. Sorio had already finished serving prison time for all of these crimes in Alaska when he was transferred to Tacoma, according to reporting from the Seattle Times. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Havi.
And there is a cold weather advisory and a high wind warning in effect starting this evening. This is KTOO.